Hey there, we at Blue Wire wanted to thank you for your continued support of this podcast. With over 90 podcasts across our network, we are committed to bringing you great content to fill that sports-shaped hole in your heart. To find more Blue Wire pods, search for us on iTunes or check out bluewirepods.com. And remember, one day sports will return and it will be glorious. Thanks for listening. On to the show.
Fans, and welcome to another episode of Bulls HQ, a Chicago Bulls podcast on the Blue Wire Sports Podcasting Network. We are brought to you today by Bet Online and Blue Chew. Thank you to them for sponsoring the show, and thank you to you for joining us on this episode of the show. And I am joined to you today, as I always am, by a man who doesn't have a gambling problem. He has a competition problem. It's C Red Fred, aka Fred Pfeiffer. Fred, how are you, sir?
Living the dream. Living the dream, Mark. That's pretty good. Pretty good, man. I had a lot of good laughs over the last couple of weeks with some of your comments, I gotta admit. But why don't you just embrace what NBC scientists have found out about your personality? You are the sleuth. You are
the Jerry Krause. We don't need to discuss that again.
Are you sure? Yes. I got a good story for you, Mark. So unfortunately, there was some heavy rainfall in the area.
Yeah.
In Chicago on the 29th, even in the 29th, into the 30th, which I think was, last Thursday into Friday? I'm losing track of the days now. And as I walked downstairs into my basement, I stepped on the carpet, and unfortunately, we had flooding in the basement. So I lost some Bulls memorabilia, but you'll be glad to know that out of all the pictures I had of beloved Bulls, the Kirk Heinrich one was the only one that remained completely dry. So I don't... I don't know how it happened. It was almost as if God had, played a cruel joke on me and left me with that completely.
Is the jersey that I purchased for you still in good condition?
Yeah, that one I have upstairs, unfortunately. I wish I would have left it in the basement. But yeah, so I thought you would get a kick out of that. Actually, I got the Jimmy Butler signed autograph is still hanging in there, but I was able to, I pretty much save all of them, but I lost the frames and everything. So it could have been worse.
Well, look, I'm sorry to hear that, but at the same time, I'm glad to hear that your true prized possessions have remained in some functional condition. So that is good to hear, and particularly the Heinrich and the Butler ones. I think that more than anything else is good to hear. But look, I'm glad you're okay. Hopefully hopefully it's not too much of an issue. It doesn't cost you too much to sort out, and hopefully it doesn't happen again, but I'm glad your prized Kirk Heinrich memorabilia is well and safe. To that note, though, Fred, where is this much-vaunted Kirk Heinrich song that we've heard so much about? Where is my Kirk Heinrich video that you were due to release by now but haven't?
Wait, is it due yet? I thought I have until the season's over.
Well, I mean, the season's over. don't play
officially
into the technicalities. But just try to check in. The thing
I
is,
will,
you brought
I
it
will
up.
Absolutely. See, I was good. I had big plans this weekend, finally, to really dedicate to getting it done. And then this happened. So I had a tear up. We have a carpet in the basement. And I had to tear up as much as I could before I could hardly move anymore. And then I had to call some people to come in and finish the job. So I was unable to, let alone get my arms above my waist, so I couldn't finish the epic Heinrich song. But I guarantee it's coming. When it comes, it's going to change the world. I have a couple of really big hits to follow after it. It's going to be like the White Album of Bulls Bulls songs, I guess. I don't know what you would call it, parody songs?
Yes, heavy emphasis on parody. which is a good way to describe your musical career. But as much as I would love to continue discussing the carpet on your floor in your basement and your thrilling music career, I think we should probably move on and get to what I want to talk about today, which is obviously the episodes 5 and 6 of The Last Dance, which we all watched yesterday. I'm sure you've done it just as I have, Fred, but I've watched it again a couple of times because that's just what I'm doing at the moment. But I also thought we could talk about Mark Eversley's introduction to Bulls fans. So he had his presser via Zoom the other week, or last week, I guess, now. So I thought we could talk about there. Maybe we can start with there, get that out of the way, get our thoughts on what he sort of mentioned in that press conference, and then we can move into a discussion on episodes 5 and 6 of Last Dance. Are you happy to do that?
Absolutely. Sounds good. Let's go.
Perfect. Well, let's start with Mark Eversley. So he made himself, along with Arturis Karnašovas, they made themselves available to media via a Zoom chat. Media was obviously pressing those guys on questions on how everything is going to run, why Eversley was the man for the job, all sorts of those sorts of things. And Eversley did a bit of a media tour last week, as much as he could online, I suppose. But I'm interested to hear from you what your initial thoughts of Mark Eversley were from you, because for me at least, I hadn't heard much of him. I didn't know much of his background beyond what I had read. I hadn't necessarily heard him express his basketball ideals and philosophy, but it was interesting to hear what he had to say. But I'm also interested to get your initial thoughts on what you thought on Mark Eversley and the way he presented himself.
I thought he did a great job. You know, I didn't expect anything less from what I've heard about him. He sounds like a really smart, intelligent young man, and I'm really excited that he's going to be starting this job. But he said, I think, you know, out of everything he said, the biggest one was it starts and ends with winning. All this, you know, glad handing and all this great stuff and excitement that we feel about the beloved Bull, if we're going 4 or 5 years out and the Bulls still don't have a winning season, all that's going to go right out the window. I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's enough talent here to turn it around pretty quick. But, you know, I think it's clear, and I think I may have mentioned this before in a previous podcast, if we have another move, if he, like they did, where, you know, imagine what would happen if we made a move like the Sixers did with Fultz. How do you think that would be taken in Chicago? We'd be talking about that for years. You know, we're not exactly the most, we talked about Doug McDermott for, you know, 2 non-All-Stars. Think about that one, you know? So it all depends on how he does on the job, but I'm going to stay positive and stay bright and feel like, I feel like so far, I've been very impressed with what he's had to say, but I didn't really expect anything less.
Yeah, look, I kind of agree, but the overwhelming sense that I got from it was he's clearly going to be the PR guy to players from a Bulls point of view. And what I mean by that is when we hear Karnašovas talk, he's very blunt. He's very straight to the point. He may come off as cool and calculated. And again, we haven't had much experience with Karnašovas, but that's been pretty clear in his delivery in the first few weeks on the job, that he's straight to the point. He's very blunt about things. And I don't know if that's the way you should maybe approach it with all players. He obviously clearly has a great respect among players, but I think the balance that what Eversley will bring from having these relationships that a lot of people have mentioned, and the fact that I didn't know this, but the fact that I think was Vince Carter his best man at his wedding or something like that? There was some sort of close personal connection with Vince Carter, to the point where there's other examples of that too, where Eversley has sort of been able to establish himself as a player first type of personality, which I think will sort of go hand in hand in the way Karnašovas sort of wants to operate the Bulls from a more strategic standpoint. So I kind of got from listening to Eversley and learning more about him why he is kind of that right fit next to someone like Karnašovas, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's very, you could tell just with his background that he's been able to form those relationships. He worked for Nike. I'm sure he learned a lot of great things working for Nike. You know, and what Pax, his day was, you know, watching the Last Dance really just made me realize how many people are completely unaware of what Paxson did in the first 3 titles. Most of these players have probably no memory, and in fact, they won't, of John Paxson playing basketball. So what might have worked from like 2003 to 2010 really holds very little sway anymore. So it was time to move on, and I'm really hoping this guy, he really understands the importance of developing in those relationships. And I think we saw in The Last Dance, if you have a person at the GM or vice president operations position who is just completely incapable of building relationships with players and positive relationships, it's going to have detrimental effects on the organization. This guy clearly knows what he's doing. So I don't think the Bulls are going to fail over the next 5 years because their GM was unable to build positive relationships with the players. I also like what he had to say about player development. That's clearly been you know, a problem over the last few years. You know, Levine's, I think, improved, but I can't say that, you know, Markkanen or Wendell Carter Jr. have really taken leaps and bounds in improvement. In fact, I think you can make a case that some of them have regressed, especially Carter Jr. You know, I want to see these – and Larry. I want to see these guys get better, and hopefully he's going to really put a focus on that. It's clear based on what he says he will.
Yeah, I think that was an interesting part of his introduction was the fact that he was sort of surprised how little staff the Bulls had on hand in terms of player development, which is kind of brutal to hear, given that the Bulls actively chose to go into a rebuild 3 years ago. So that was illuminating for us fans, but clearly for Eversley as well, and I'm sure kind of showed us too. So I don't, now that Eversley is in place, obviously JJ Paul came aboard, Tim Connolly's brother, Pat Connolly, came on board. He followed kind of Chauvis too. I doubt that is the last change that we will see from a coaching or, sorry, from a front office perspective. I think there will be some more changes and additions to come in the coming weeks and months. But it's clear that there's probably going to be some changes on the coaching staff too. And that, you know, outside of Jim Boylan, whether Jim Boylan is a coach or not, it's clear, or at least I'm hoping based on what Eversley sort of alluded to, that the coaching staff potentially is going to beefed up, whether that's Jim Boylan's coaching staff or someone else, because it just seems like they're under-resourced too.
Yeah, what do you feel about, you know, his statements? So I have the quote written out here. It's really early. Coach Jim Boylan and I did have a conversation earlier in the week where he called to congratulate me on accepting the position. Just like anything else on our staff, we're going to utilize our time to evaluate everybody on staff, not only players, coaches, but also people in the front office. I've spoken to Coach. We had a really great conversation. Looking forward to spending time with him in Chicago when we're afforded the opportunity, end quote. You know, I can't think of any, it'd probably be the worst case scenario that Jim Boylan still head coaches team next year. On a scale of 1 to 10, you know, with 1 being, what percentage would you put that Jim Boylan is back next year?
I have to assume it's very low. I'm not going to say it's 0% because, I mean, there are those rumors circulating, and they're mostly coming from Joe Cowley, who's, I'm assuming, got a source that's close to ownership that, you know, they do like Jim Boylan, who Jim Boylan is as a person. We obviously know the Reinsdorf are super loyal people, so for them to sort of kick someone out that they do like is big for them to do. So I can't put it at 0%, but I want to put it like at as close to 0% as I can. And maybe that's just more hope than anything else. But I don't know. There's just no possible way that, given the seismic changes that the Bulls are going through right now, when we know, you know, looking at other organizations and the way they've sort of handled a new front office coming through, these front office executives obviously like to put in place their own coaches. Like, it just makes no sense to not replace Jim Boylan now when you're going through these wholesale changes. Like, now is the ample time to do it. And particularly when someone like Jim Boylan is probably the worst coach in the NBA. I mean, it's not like you're firing Phil Jackson here or something of that nature. You're just kicking to the curb a pretty bad coach. So it's not, it shouldn't be that dramatic, I think, of a decision to make. So I won't put it at 0%, but I'm going to say it's 1% or 2%.
Boy, it'd be horrible if he's back.
It would be bad.
It would call in question either one of two things. Either call in question this front office's ability to determine, you know, to understand what is needed for this team, or B, you know, the ownership is meddling and causing problems with the front office, because it's got to be one or the other. It's not based on merit. He's been a disaster.
He has it. That's a good point. So we'll see how it all plays out. But this is going to be weird to say, and I don't know how strongly I feel about this. Like, I kind of felt sorry for Jim Boylan to the smallest degrees possible, because when Eversley said that there's just not enough development coaches to sort of help him out, and the fact that it was also reported this week that Jim Boylan was actually doing some general manager tasks because Gar Foreman had sort of faded into the background as a scout. If Boylan is doing all those things and having to do general manager duties whilst not having enough, I guess, personnel around him to help him from a development standpoint, the fact that he is a first-time coach as well, then I kind of sort of feel bad, very slightly feel bad for him, that he would be put into that situation by these people who supposedly like and endorse him, like Paxton and Reinsdorf, that they wouldn't necessarily put enough around him to help him out. Not to suggest that even if he had those resources that it would go any differently. But yeah, for a brief moment, I kind of empathize with Jim Boylan, which is weird to say.
Yeah, that was a very bizarre moment for you. Let's just put it that way. Let's end it there. Very low moment for you. Bizarre. We'll just very move low on moment. From that. I mean, there's no doubt the guy was, you know, what are we talking about, Mark? The timeouts, do you remember this? You saw the season.
I remember on the bench all year. The guy's
a complete jackass. He shouldn't be coaching any team. He's a nice guy. He should be an assistant or, you know, like collecting tickets, but he shouldn't be head coach of an NBA basketball team. He just shouldn't. I'd honestly be uncomfortable if he was coaching my son's seventh grade team. Next or the sixth grade team next year.
Well, I've said before that you remind me of a lot of Jim Boylan, so maybe he could be your assistant coach, the assistant to the assistant coach, which you are. So
don't make me bring up the NBC Sports Chicago team of psychologists again.
Look, that's where I differ from Jerry Krause, because Jerry Krause wouldn't have these empathetic thoughts that I just had. So there you go. I'm not like Jerry Krause at all. So I think that's been made clear. But yeah, look, it was a good introduction for Eversley. It was positive comments from him. I like the way it's shaping up between him and Karnišovas. There's a bit of a yin to their yang. Both will front the media. Both will be sort of in charge of doing that. So we'll get both of their perspectives throughout all of that. So again, it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out. But much like the Karnišovas hire, this seems to be like something that's heading in the right direction. I'm going to trust Arturis on this one, even though last time we discussed that the Sixers' decisions whilst Eversley was there, well, who knows how much of them were his, but we haven't loved too much of what the Sixers have done whilst Eversley was there, and even during his days at Toronto, there were some odd choices that the Toronto Raptors made whilst he was there, probably more to do with Brian Colangelo than anyone else, but still, let's trust Karnišovas on that one. But do you have anything else that you wanted to talk about on Eversley, or should we move on to The Last Dance?
No, let's move on to The Last Dance. I think we've said it all needs to be said. All that matters is what he does going forward, and let's try to support him until he proves us otherwise.
Yes, good point. I think that's a fair way to approach it. So let's move on to what I really want to talk about, which is The Last Dance, episodes 5 and 6. Those two episodes aired the other day. It pretty much continued off where we expected it to from episodes 3 and 4. We finished in 91 essentially on episode 4, where the Bulls had sort of won their first title. So typically, obviously, episodes 5 and 6 carried on from there, sort of showcasing the rise of Jordan and the Bulls from 92 into 1993. I'm assuming next week we're going to go into the details of the first retirement. So we went through those two championship years and then obviously floated back to the final year, the last dance, the 98 season. So again, an interesting episode. I thought these were probably the best two episodes given the subject matter. I don't know how you feel about that statement. It probably wasn't as flattering to Jordan and the Bulls as maybe some of their previous episodes have been, but given the seismic subject matter of these two episodes, I thought it was actually the two best episodes.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked at some of the topics they got into, you know, frankly, especially with Michael making the final decision on this stuff. Like, you know, one thing that's always irked me is this whole gambling discussion. You know, back then it irked me, and as I get older, I get more and more angry about it, and I just felt like it was so unfair. You know, I was a caddy during these years, so my job to pay for my high school, I went to a private high school that I wanted to play sports at. So in agreement with my parents, I would caddy and work in the summer to pay for my tuition. And one of those days, right around 92 or 93, Jordan showed up at the course. He gets out of the car and man, he just, I could still see it in my head, just seeing him get out, how tall he was, how impressive looking he was. It was like a awe-inspiring moment, like an angel appearing. And then he ran out in the course, and one of my buddies got the caddy with him and told me about the whole story. And he wasn't gambling any more money than almost every other member of that club was, every country club on the south side of Chicago. You know, so it's like people were making a big deal about this. Hey, big surprise here. People with a lot of money gamble on the golf course. It happens all the time. And for people to make a big deal about it in 93, you know, knowing how much money people were gambling on the course then, I thought was so unfair, so ludicrous. It was just outrageous to me. And I don't even know what the whole goal of the whole thing was other than to tear down someone that, you know, I really respected and loved. So I'm curious to get your opinion on that whole situation with the gambling. What did you feel about it?
Well, that was kind of the theme of more so episode 6 than 5, but also 5. But it was clearly a story from Jordan's perspective of him being built up to be this super duper megastar. You know, obviously the biggest athlete maybe ever. And he was sort of coming to that peak of his powers to the point where he was almost untouchable from a media sense. So, and they alluded it to on the documentary that we like to build people up to then obviously bring them down. And it felt like, you know, the whole gambling issue was part of that, trying to find some sort of negative on Jordan, who had up until that point a pretty clean reputation. So there was a gambling issue. There was obviously the fact that he didn't necessarily, or he wasn't actively out there being an activist for the politician that who was running against that abhorrent Republican in Carolina. So Jesse Holmes, was it? Was that his name?
Jesse Holmes, yeah.
Yeah. So there was a lot made about the fact that, you know, Michael wasn't Muhammad Ali in the way he wasn't an activist. So in that sense, he was torn down for that, the fact that he wasn't using his profile to draw change on that seismic level. He just wanted to be a basketball player. And then from there, there was obviously the gambling issue. And that, to me, it was interesting that both topics were in there, but I think Jordan wanted to have them included in there because it just goes to show how difficult his life became, where he obviously transcended every athlete ever, became just this super duper megastar to the point where he couldn't live anything close to a normal life just from the sheer volume of attention he was receiving, but also the amount of scrutiny he was receiving to the point where, you know, minor things maybe were maybe built up and were built up in a way to bring him down. That was the sense that I got away from watching episodes 5 and 6.
Yeah, I always, it's kind of hard to, in today's era where athletes are so political and politically motivated, often are, and it's always such a big topic of conversation. I think it's hard for people to understand that it really wasn't that way. I didn't feel that way in the late 80s and 90s. I mean, you brought up Muhammad Ali, and absolutely, he was political, but he was almost forced into it because they took away his livelihood. He decided not to go to Vietnam, and they stripped him of his title. So it was a completely different situation, and then he became politically motivated. And I'm not saying that it was, Jordan should have been the same way as Muhammad Ali, but it was a completely different situation. You know, Muhammad Ali was a victim in retrospect, a horrible decision to take away, ban him basically from boxing for three years. I'm not entirely sure of the circumstances around it, but I do remember in 91, Michael was so universally beloved that for him to wade into the political scene, I mean, that's not something that a lot of players did. Walter Payton didn't do that in Chicago. There were a lot of great icons in that era that just didn't necessarily get political. Bo Jackson was huge in the late 80s, I remember. And, you know, these were never topics of conversation. So I'm not saying that there was talk that he should have been involved, more politically involved, but I don't know if he, I just think it's unfair to often criticize Michael Jordan. It seems like there's always way you can criticize him for no matter what he did. And I think it's just unfair in retrospect to do that 20 some years later, 30 years later.
Yeah. I mean, he alluded to that fact in the doco. He basically said, no matter what I would do, whether it was speaking out or not speaking at all, there was always going to be something that disappointed someone. And even Barack Obama alluded to it as well, where he sort of suggested that in the US, that, you know, if an African-American was to rise to some sort of prominence, that they almost had to do so on certain terms, or, you know, they carried an extra burden and they had to adhere to a certain way. So he could understand why maybe Jordan towed that line or didn't necessarily want to be an activist. So, yeah, it's an interesting conversation. It's obviously a large conversation. It's one we could spend an entire podcast discussing whether we should be looking to athletes like Jordan or anyone else to actually be an activist of sorts. Sometimes when they are, we like it. I mean, look, some of the things LeBron James has done has been amazing to see. We also see LeBron sort of with the whole China and Hong Kong issue, You know, that was maybe not so great from LeBron being an activist standpoint. He received a lot of criticism for that, which is probably what Jordan was alluding to, where the fact where no matter what you do or say, there's going to be someone that is going to come after you, no matter what your stance is. Obviously, the whole Republican buy sneakers too comment was filtered into the conversation too. But
there's one thing I do want to say. There's no question. If LeBron had stepped out and actually called out China, that would have been a lot more. The results of that comment would have been a lot more financially devastating for him.
For sure.
You know. So and for Michael to do what LeBron does now, like now, if you're going to be politically active, you're almost going to get celebrated. You're going to be the toast of a lot of parties. You're going to get a lot of pats on the back. Colin Kaepernick is beloved in most circles. Most of the people I know love him.
Some
circles, but the circles where he's not beloved or people actually are angry about it, who hangs out in those circles that we know?
Nobody. Well, yeah.
Nobody,
I mean,
really cares.
No one that I know, but probably no one that I choose to know either. But the point is that those people obviously exist, and they exist in large
quantities.
They do,
but I don't think they're as enlarged as you think. I think the vast majority of people really don't care. And that's a different thing than people actually get angry about it.
Yeah.
Michael Jordan, if he would have done something in 1991 in this situation, maybe not in the Helms case since it's local politics, but let's just say it was something else. The ramifications would have probably been a lot more severe in that era than in 2020, where, you know, LeBron could say something and people are going to be, for the most part, supportive, especially in the NBA community. So I don't even think it's even remotely apples to apples. And if that's part of the comparison or discussion between LeBron and Michael, it's completely unfair.
Yeah, maybe. But I guess he's the nearest facsimile to Jordan at this point, maybe from a talent point of view, but even just from a pure, you know, athlete gravity standpoint. So that was the overwhelming theme for me, that just how much burden Jordan how much of a burden Jordan had to carry as being this cultural icon, which I want to talk about a little bit more in detail from a basketball standpoint. But before we do that, let's tell the listeners about this week's sponsors. First, let me tell you about Bet Online. With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, Bet Online, still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. From their online casino to poker and blackjack, they are bringing Vegas to you. Missing the NFL? Then no problem. BetOnline has live, daily Madden NFL 20 simulations you can bet on. You can also still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even Nathan's hot dog eating contest. All of that is open 24 hours a day, and all of it is online. Use promo code BLUEWIRE to join today and receive your new welcome bonus. Bet Online, your online wagering solution. We are also brought to you today by Blue Chew. Guys, looking to last longer and go a few extra rounds? Get to BlueChew.com. BlueChew.com has the first ever chewable that brings your performance in the bedroom to another level. They've got the same active ingredients that are in Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. And since they are chewable, they work faster. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. Plus, you don't need to go to the doctor's office or spend time waiting in a pharmacy line. Blue Chew's online physician is free of cost, and once approved, your order ships straight to your door in discreet packaging. Here's a great deal for you guys. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first order free when you use promo code BLUEWIRE. Just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code BLUEWIRE. Back to the podcast now. We were talking about Jordan's gravity as an athlete, as a cultural icon, and I think that was the other key takeaway of episodes 5 and 6, where it, I guess, after 91 into 92, when the Bulls won their second championship, they went back to back. That is when Jordan really started to take off as a global phenomenon, I guess, and that in part was due to the Dream Team and all that sort of stuff as well. So I want to talk about that and the fact that, you know, how big that the Dream Team was for international basketball. But I think another interesting thing as well was, I don't know if you got this sense, but who the hell knows if Nike is what it is today without Michael Jordan? I think that was an interesting aspect of episode 5, the fact that he obviously signed with Nike. Nike were a smaller startup at that point. They aren't what they are today. And I, just the overwhelming thing that I keep thinking about, you know, Jordan, when I watch these documentaries, how much money he's made, not only for himself, but for everyone else. I think about Nike. I think about the Chicago Bulls, Jerry Reinsdorf, obviously. But yeah, there was another thing I was thinking about is, what the hell is Nike without Jordan at this standpoint?
Yeah, there's so much, Mark, that that not just Nike. I mean, the whole city of Chicago owes to him.
Yeah.
And I brought this up. I don't know if you noticed that one police, the former police department, who was his security head, who was betting with him, who gave the shrug when he won the bet. That guy, I read an interesting interview. That guy passed away, actually, earlier this year.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But there was a really interesting point of the article that I was reading in complex.com where he was talking about when they went into his old restaurant, how everybody, I'll actually read it directly from here. Let me get it. Give me 1 second to find it. But basically, it was basically saying he'd walk in there and the whole city would stand up and start clapping. The whole restaurant would. It was like, he brought so much financially to the city. I remember it before, Michael, it wasn't to the same level it was. In the 80s, you haven't been to Chicago yet, but most people who've visited Chicago that I know always say the same thing about how clean it is in the areas that, you know, where most people visit. And it wasn't always like that. You know, I remember in the 80s, it wasn't the best city probably in the United States. And you could argue that due to the financial ramifications of people coming to visit the city due to Michael Jordan, the popularity of Michael Jordan had a massive effect on the coffers for the city, the amount of people who would visit and stay at the hotels. It just brought in a tremendous amount of income, when, especially at a time in the winter when most people weren't coming to the city. So I always said there's two people who did more for the financial, you know, growth of Chicago, the outside of the actual political sphere, would be Michael Jordan and Harry Carey. Harry Carey basically did a advertisement for Chicago Cubs, brought tons of people into the city to visit Wrigley Field. And the same thing with Michael Jordan. So the ramifications of what he did go far beyond just basketball. It's in the billions, I'm certain.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I mean, we already know these things, but seeing the way it's packaged in the documentary, it just clicks again. And it's like, oh yeah, he did that. Like, he's indirectly related to this, or he had this impact on this company. He made them billions. We can talk about the Bulls. The Bulls are a global icon because of Jordan. I am sitting here today talking to you, a guy in Chicago. We're doing a Chicago Bulls podcast because of Michael Jordan in a weird, crazy way. So not to suggest that Michael Jordan has made us billions just yet, Fred, but maybe once this podcast maybe takes off, maybe we, at that point we can send something over to Michael as a bit of a thank you. But
I'm pretty sure though, Mark, you know, there's not an Australian and some guy in St. Paul who are talking about the T-Wolves. You know what I mean? Like, I'm pretty sure they do not. You know what I'm saying? Maybe.
There's Tom Thibodeau's impact on the Timberwolves bear the fruit Thibodeau of several successful podcasts?
I just know the Bulls are a world brand because of him. Without Michael Jordan, they never achieved this, and it's had ramifications for decades. You know, that's why we're talking about it now, and that's why they're so beloved.
For sure.
And also John Paxson's big shot in the third, to win the third title.
Yeah, we can maybe talk about that later. Probably not. but that's why I wanted to talk about the Dream Team, because that was probably my favorite aspect of these episodes, because it had that international flavor to it, and the fact that the Dream Team was so iconic and was so influential in growing basketball globally. And for me, being in a completely different continent to you, obviously talking to you about a team in your continent, about an NBA team that Michael Jordan played on. Obviously, the Dream Team means a ton, obviously, for the US-based people, clearly. But even for someone like me, there is some weird connection to a Dream Team like that. So that I found interesting to watch back. And those practices and the footage that they did include of those practices, how Michael... Or how the transition of greatness from Larry and Magic to Michael was sort of occurring right there in those practices. And that is when Jordan became the clear alpha of alphas in the NBA. I thought that was really interesting. And I could just watch the Dream Team stuff for hours upon hours.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And the whole practice, the footage of the practice where Magic and Michael were going at it, it was so great. It really was. And I think also, too, what was kind of really interesting about that and wasn't really talked about is that was after the HIV.
Yeah.
Magic's HIV, which happened in the fall of 91. And there was still a lot of controversy like that, you know, about playing with Magic. I'm not sure if it was still at that point, which would have been 92, summer 92. But, you know, for Michael and those guys who embrace him and to, you know, kind of erase, it really erased a lot of the stigma around it. I think it was a very positive thing. And obviously, you know, thank God Magic still with us today. But even at that time, we were all worried he was going to be dead within like 2 or 3 years, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a really interesting situation. But I loved that whole, you know, how they were going at it and everything. And then he just established himself as the true alpha. It was so fantastic. Although I thought he did that clearly in the finals before that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
The 6 threes in the first game is just so mind-blowing to me. I still can't believe it happened.
Yeah, I kind of wish they spent more time on that 92 team. They kind of whizzed through that a little bit. And there wasn't much on that playoff series, Jim, more generally. They talked about the 93 Knicks and in the lead up to, you know, obviously the Bulls beating the Suns, beating Chuck, and now obviously Chuck was part of the docker, which was great to see. Anytime Barkley speaks is always entertaining. But they kind of dismissed that 92 team a little too quickly for mine, and the way they sort of played it off against the Blazers. I mean, I would have liked to see more on that team because that was a fantastic team. And of all the title teams, that one's maybe slept on to the point where we obviously think about 91 because that was, you know, against the Lakers, it was against Magic. We think about 93 because against that was against Barkley, the Suns, and the way that ended with your old mate Paxton hitting that shot. But the title in between sort of gets diminished some, if we can even say that about a title. At least that's how I feel about it. So I would have liked a couple more minutes maybe on that 92 season, but we didn't necessarily get it. But yeah, it is what it is, I guess.
Yeah, and that was a great team too, the Blazers. Yeah. I mean, I felt a little bit bad for Clyde Drexler because he was truly a fantastic, great professional. It's just, you know, no one is equal to Michael. I loved that whole scene too where he was like, you know, he basically took offense to the fact that people were talking about Clyde in the same, you know, in the sentence. It was just so great how he came out and really just established his greatness over the. But you're right. Like that team was, I thought Wilbon made the point that he thought that team was better than the 72-10 team. I would disagree with that just because, you know, 72-10 team had Kukoc and Rodman, and I think Kukoc as the fourth player was better than anyone that 92 team had as the fourth best. So I would still give the edge to 72-10, but what a great year that was, man. And that was really where you smashed, you know, the Chicago had, you know, the 85 Bears probably for 30 years. That was it. I think between 1963 and 1992, they only had the 85 Bears, and for him to win two in a row in 91 and 92, it smashed all the associations of Chicago being loser city forever.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For 100% for sure. And yeah. And I mean, coming back to, and obviously going from that 92 platform where he was obviously a two-time NBA champion at that point, going into the Dream Team, I mean, that's where he really cemented himself as that global icon. Clearly, he was already establishing that path anyway, but we've seen the footage anyway, but the footage of him sort of walking through Barcelona at the Olympics with those absolutely huge signs, or the signage of him, those Nike signs, where he's just sort of looking back on himself or looking up to himself more pointedly. I mean, that was awesome to see. And going back to Magic, though, I did get the sense that look, the Dream Team probably wins anyway. It probably all goes to plan. No, there's no one beating the Dream Team, clearly. But I just wonder how differently it would have been if Magic wasn't Magic and he wasn't as welcoming of Michael, and if he was maybe a little bit more ruthless and maybe was less interested in sort of handing over the reins to a Jordan, even though at that point, like he sort of mentioned, he was effectively, his career was done at that point. But that was another interesting thing that I've noticed over the last couple episodes, of how Magic is being painted versus someone like Isaiah Thomas, which he's being painted as that way. But I think it's also fair to say that's just their personalities as well. But maybe the dynamics of that dream team is completely different if Magic isn't who Magic is. And that's what I wanted to talk about next, is how they alluded to that after that practice session. It got so heated. All of them were talking about that being the best basketball game they've ever been involved with. And the fact that when they got on the bus afterwards, how there was, you know, a noticeable tension in the air until Magic broke it. So I'm really enjoying Magic and the way he's sort of being portrayed, or the way he's portraying himself in pure Magic fashion within this doco.
He's a special human being, man. I don't know if you're aware of this, but Magic Johnson, Mark, came down on a coin flip for the Chicago Bulls to get him. Were you aware of that?
Yeah. Yep.
You were?
Yeah, I believe so. I've read that somewhere. I didn't obviously didn't experience it. I'm not as old as you, but I believe I read that somewhere. Yeah.
For those who aren't aware of it, the Bulls had a coin flip in 1980.
Yeah.
To get Magic Johnson, and they put it up to the fans. The fans voted tails. It landed heads, and Lakers got Magic Johnson, and we got David Greenwood, and the rest is history. But you know, I'm grateful that happened. Like, let's be honest, if we got Magic, we would have never gotten Michael. And as great as Magic was, Michael was better. So I'm very happy how things worked out. But Magic is a special human being, man, and it's impossible not to love the guy. He was a fantastic basketball player. I have him third in my list all time. I love the guy, and you know, I thought his interviews, and to me, some of the highlights of this have been him, Bird, and Michael together. The video that you saw in the 1998 All-Star game, I thought was really fantastic. And just to hear players of that caliber talk about Michael Jordan says it all to me. To earn the esteem of your peers like that, that's all you need to hear. You know, I'm not sure if the greatest players of this era are going to be talking about LeBron with as much love in the next, you know, 30 years, but we'll see. Maybe they will.
Yeah, maybe we'll see. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, that was that 98 All-Star game stuff was great footage to get that inside locker room footage. But it was also eerie because that's where we got to see Kobe talking about Michael, which obviously carries different connotations now, knowing what we do know of Kobe, obviously, you know, recording that prior to his death, unfortunately. So watching that and episode 5 opening with Kobe, that was a tough to watch. And the fact that the way he was talking about his relationship with Jordan, I thought that was really, it was great to see. And I was glad that we got to hear Kobe say that, because we obviously, at Kobe's eulogy, Michael spoke, and he spoke so fondly about Kobe and their relationship. So getting to hear Kobe talk about it, and, you know, knowing what we do know, that was tough.
Do you feel better or worse about Michael than you did before this all started?
Better.
Absolutely. Yeah, me too. I love him even more.
We spoke possible. About this last week. There was nothing that they could show or do that maybe could negatively portray Jordan, and maybe that would never happen given that he's involved in the production of this documentary. But I mean, there would have to be something truly horrific for me to change any position on it. And I don't know, even the gambling thing, I was just thinking about, like, how Jordan was talking about how he was looking at gambling as an outlet from a competition standpoint. I was just thinking, well, maybe if the NBA players were better, then Michael Jordan didn't necessarily have to gamble and have enough competition on the floor. Maybe that's why he was so into gambling. So I'm just finding ways to justify Jordan's actions, even if he's less... I wouldn't call his gambling problem shady or anything like that, but if we want to cloud that in that way, I'm even trying to find ways to justify that. So to answer your question, there is no way Jordan was going to come away from this looking bad in my eyes.
Yeah, I didn't expect to feel love him anymore, though, because I didn't think it was possible to love him more than I did.
Yeah.
And I just think he's been so entertaining and so – he's just so brutally honest in these interviews that somehow I've kind of like just – it's even grown for me. And I just love the guy. I love his family. That was one thing that also hit me. When he went to Nike, his mom and dad were with him. You know, he really brought them in on a lot of these decisions. Just like, I just felt like I couldn't help feeling like good people. You know what I mean? It's just like, especially at the core, especially his mother seems like such a great human being. It's just like, you know, all his good ass, and I'm sure his father was great too, but especially his mom, all her best aspects were somehow brought to Michael, you know. So I really can't help but like these people.
Yeah, well, 100%. Like, from a character standpoint, I mean, I'll always have questions about how, if he had to be so crazy about it, I guess, and just the way he approached it. Like, I prefer my athletes maybe to be like someone like Tim Duncan, as an example. Maybe that speaks more to me than anything else, but
or the coach's at the same son. Time,
I love Jordan being the complete maniac that he is. So, and as an example, like, you watch this, you learn more about his personality, obviously, but then it just triggers you to go back and look at games again. And I was looking at his stats from the 93 finals and the fact that he averaged over 41 a game. It's just like, really? It's like, yeah, things like that make you just, your appreciation grows even fonder, which you didn't think was possible, but clearly it was.
I think there was also a clear delineation between his, it's really become more apparent to me, the first three-peat, the second three-peat. Like, he was a lot, he was just a better, in my opinion, overall, he was a better basketball player in the first three-peat, yeah. Although he was probably even better or stronger mentally in the second three-peat, but my God, he was just so fast, and he was an unstoppable force. It was just so great to watch. I encourage everyone to go watch a 55-point game against the Suns. To me, that could be the all-time favorite. Out of all the ones I've watched, I just thought it was just so incredible.
Yeah, 41 points, 9 rebounds, 6 assists, played 46 minutes in the finals. I mean, that is madman type stuff. I mean, he's a psychopath. But that's why we love him. But the only other thing I wanted to raise and talk about, because we had discussed it last week, is when we were going to see some Tony Kukoc. And we got to see, or we assumed it would come when they talked more in depth about the 98 season, maybe that second three-peat. But obviously, we got a little bit of it, of Tony in episodes 5 and 6 when they were talking about the Dream Team and the fact that Scotty and Michael were coming after him in that game against Croatia. And it was good to see that. Obviously, I was glad that they included the second game that they played against Tony as well, where he was much better in that game. And it was just interesting and fascinating to see all how that whole dynamic played out and to get Tony's perspective on it, given that, you know, he was a Boston City basketball fan, a Jordan fan. He had no idea that they hated him, and the way he was sort of introduced to the two guys that he would end up playing with and two guys that he would win championships was, I thought that was really funny as well.
Well, yeah, plus in retrospect to Pippen's comment, he couldn't play in the NBA. It was so ridiculously laughable. Such a, and at least Michael kind of, you know, said, oh, come on. You know, like that was so ridiculous. I just thought, big picture, it's the incompetence of Kraus. Even when he correctly identifies a fantastic player like Tony Kukoc in one of his shining moments, his stupid personality and his inability to get along with other humans caused them to hate him so much that they embarrassed the guy, you know. And I'm glad that Tony, I thought, was really put in a good light. You know, Wilbon said he came back. You know, I thought brought up a lot of good points, and he came back. I always thought it was a little bit strange how hard they went at him too. I always thought it was kind of weird. Like, you know, this guy's going to be your teammate sooner or later. You know, eventually, why don't we just try and embrace him and make him better? But it just says a lot about Tony Kukoc. He's seen a lot worse than this, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that was something I was thinking about when watching these scenes was, I mean, you could probably say Pippen and Kukoc were the best two moves that Kraus made. And fact that both of those guys and the way they were introduced together, and you think about the way two draft picks nowadays and the way you would ideally hope to have two guys come together to sort of form your franchise, you would hope they'd come together as a unit, not necessarily as competition or as Pippen being threatened by Kukoc from him taking his spot, but also, you know, taking money away from the table, given that how enamored Kraus was with Kukoc at that point and what that meant for Pippen, and obviously how Jordan and Pippen felt about it. So I completely understand why they were psychopaths about it. But yeah, it does speak to the fact that it all came down to Kraus and his inability to manage personalities or manage his own personality, maybe. But that was interesting. And I guess the other takeaway for me was how good Kukoc was and how much he probably sacrificed his prime on those second three-peat teams and how good he potentially could have been. And I was just thinking about how good and skilled he was. And just in my own head, I was putting him on the current day Bulls. And I mean, if he was on this current day's Bulls, he would be so far away the best prospect on this roster. That's how good and skilled he was.
No doubt. I mean, I always said, you know, I wrote that incredible article about the most underrated players in Bulls history. And that's one of my few regrets is I didn't put him at number one. You know, a little recency bias there. I had Gordon number one. Tony was a better player. And there's, you'll see, hopefully they'll focus on this in game seven against Indiana. We don't win title number six. We lose to Indiana if Tony Kukoc doesn't come through and, you know, put up an incredible performance and get 21 points and saved us in the third quarter. Also, game five against Utah in the finals, I think he had 30 points on like 14 shots. He was absolutely outstanding. He was 7-11, 3-4 from three against the Pacers for 21 points. And then he had 30 points on 11-13 shooting, 4-6 from three against the Utah Jazz in game five, a loss at home. But man, I mean, how do you, just incredible performances there. He was really playing at such a high level. He just had no faults on the offensive end. That's something I always bring up. You know, defensively, he did have some deficiencies, but he could pass, he could shoot, yeah. He could rebound. I love the guy.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm predisposed for loving any European player who's, you know, absurdly tall that can pass like a guard. So I just absolutely love those players. And obviously, Tony was that, could shoot, could pass, could do everything you needed on offense, was a triple threat, and just came over and was prepared to be, you know, the ultimate teammate, the six-man type player for this team. Just, you know, it ultimately sacrificed his numbers to get rings. And he probably could have been a better player, let's say, or had more vaunted numbers on a different team. But not to say his numbers weren't very good for the Bulls, because they were, particularly in the minutes he was playing. But yeah, I watching Tony in the few minutes that he was on the screen, I came back with an overwhelming fondness for him as well. So every Bull that I've seen thus far, I keep, you know, they're legend in my mind, at least, that keeps growing, where my level of detest for people like Kraus and more so Jerry Reinsdorf, that continues to grow as well. So it'll be interesting to see where that sort of positions itself after episode 10. But I've got a feeling that after we conclude this docu-series, that I'll be ready to be extremely, extremely angry at Jerry Reinsdorf.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way around it, especially when you see that, I mean, you saw in this episode, it was in the middle of the season or right around the All-Star break, that Kraus reiterated that Coach Jackson would not be back, Phil Jackson would not be back, and if Michael didn't decided not to play, that was his choice. It's like, is this bizarre world? Like, what are we talking about? What is this? Why
weird.
Is this jackass? And they also showed after the 92, it was either 92 or 91 when they're celebrating, he's talking about organizations winning championships again. You know, just what a jackass. Like, he's talking about the equipment manager, like, almost putting them on equal footing as these players. It's just so incredibly stupid. You know, like, just shut up. I don't even watching it now, it's almost incredible. I mean, I was angry then. I'm almost just, like, incredulous now, like, this actually happened.
Yeah, look, I don't have too much of a problem with the whole organizations win championships thing. So I know what he's trying to say there, even if he's coming across as a bit of a dumbass there. But I understand his point there, and I mentioned it before, but the Raptors are exactly that. They're an organization who won a championship. Obviously, Kawhi, he was a big part of that and the main reason for that. But, you know, we talk about Masai, we talk about their coaching and how that sort of impacted everything. So I got what Kraus was saying there, but they had an element in episode 6 where they had a quote from Jordan where he was essentially saying, I'm paraphrasing, but the fact that they have not been very loyal to him from a contractual standpoint or wanting to move on or break up the team. I can't remember the exact quote, but he was sort of alluding to the fact that he's been more loyal to the team, to the city, than the team has been back to him, which is it is weird to continue to talk, to think about that and talk about that. And that is, I'm assuming, where this is going to head in the next couple of episodes here. But I just get that overwhelming feeling again after taking it in all, thinking about how it all ended, thinking what could have potentially been. It's wildly, wildly frustrating, Fred.
It is, especially now I'm sitting here and I see breaking news, I guess from his unpublished biography, Jerry Kraus details similarities with Michael Jordan. Oh, my God. So I haven't even read it yet. I'm just going to let that sit and we'll end on that. But there aren't any similarities, Jerry. My goodness. Holy smokes.
No, not many that I can think of.
Besides, they have two lungs, maybe?
I'm sure it'll get into their uncanny ability to work, you know, to put work in and their quest for dominance or something like that. But
something dumb on Jerry's
part. Some crazy stuff like that. But I think it's fair to end it there. But thank you again, Frederick, for sharing your thoughts with me as you have been doing the last few months on Bulls HQ. Appreciate you doing that. Listeners of the show, you can follow Fred on Twitter at CBEFred. And Fred, I'm sure you'll have an update for us soon on all the Kirk Heinrich songs and videos that you owe me.
Yeah, I think I'll make a commitment. I'll have the song out by next Sunday.
Okay.
You put it out there. I think it's time.
Okay.
I think it's time. You know why? What episode's coming up?
Seven and eight.
Episode 7. Yep. Oh. You know what the you know what the meaning is behind that number.
For some reason, does that mean like Netflix or ESPN will go to show it and all of a sudden, you know, there'll be a massive power outage as grids will go out everywhere and then we won't be able to watch episode 7? Is that what you're suggesting?
I hope that doesn't happen, Mark. I'm just telling you. I think it's time now, as we head into episode 7, I got to redo the mantra now. In fact, I'm going to go run to Twitter right now and talk about episode 7 coming up, .. 7 pick and 17. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll think long and hard about your great tweet that's upcoming. So be on the lookout for that, listeners to the show, and follow Fred for all his great thoughts. Great in air quotes here. On Twitter.com at CBEFred. Whilst you're doing that, you can follow me too at MK Hoops. Follow the show at Bulls HQ Pod. If you want to send us an email or be part of the Bulls HQ Discord forum, send us an email, bullshq@gmail.com. But that just about does it for this episode of Bulls HQ. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week to talk about episodes 7 and 8 of The Last Dance. But until then, this has been Bulls HQ. Speak then, Bulls fans.